Hi, everyone. Welcome back to the Palisades podcast on this lovely Thursday in Los Angeles. We're very happy today to have the new commanding officer for West LAPD Operations, Captain Jonathan Tom, with us today. As a reminder and an intro, I'm Mariam Zahr. I'm co-host of this podcast here with Steve Krohn, who will lead us off today and maybe give us a reminder of what he does in his day job and how that makes it kind of interesting that today we're talking to Captain Tom. Captain Tom is a Captain 3 for West LA. He was born and raised in Los Angeles. He's a proud fifth-generation Angeleno. I know he'll tell us a little bit about his family and his history. He's a product of the Los Angeles Unified School District. He attended Third Street Elementary, Los Angeles Center for Enriched Studies, and University High School right nearby. In 1991, Captain Tom graduated from the University of Southern California, where he earned his Bachelor of Science degree in Business Administration and is a member of the USC Alumni Association. He has served as commanding officer in five different bureaus of the LAPD, and he'll tell us about some of those because they're really interesting. And he's now, and most newly, the commanding officer over at West Los Angeles area, which is a large command. He can tell us how far it stretches, but we're happy to have him today. We're happy to introduce him to the Palisades community. I know he's already been up there. He's participated in the homeless count. He's already met with some of the community leaders, and I know he's eager to get to know others. So thank you for joining us today. Welcome to the Palisades podcast. And Steve?
Good morning, everyone, and good morning, Captain Tom. Yes, I'm Steve Krohn. I'm co-host with Mariam Zahr of the Palisades podcast. This is a particularly interesting interview for me because those of you who know me know that for the last 45 or so years, I've been a criminal defense lawyer here in Los Angeles County. And consequently, over those years, I've had thousands of cases in court. And because I practice in Santa Monica, a lot of them have to do with the LAPD. And occasionally I've represented LAPD officers on Board of Rights issues and other matters relating to their practice. So my way of practicing has always been to get along if you can. And I've always had good relationships with police officers and district attorneys that I've dealt with. So it's interesting and it's a pleasure to have you here with us, Captain Tom.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
Great. So what I'd like to do is, Mariam told us a little bit about what you're doing now and what you've done in your career, but if you would, let's go back to growing up here in L.A. What part of L.A. did you grow up in?
I grew up in an area called Country Club Park. There's a Country Club Park. It's around Olympic and Western, around that area. It's a historic neighborhood. Originally, I believe it was the Los Angeles Country Club. It was the original site of the Los Angeles Country Club. There's a huge estate that's there that served as the clubhouse, and so that's why it got that name.
And you went to elementary, middle school, high school there?
I went to Third Street Elementary, which is in Hancock Park. It's very close nearby. And then I went to Los Angeles Center for Enriched Studies, which was a magnet school. And then I ended up going to University High School, class of 87.
Okay. And when you were growing up in that area, did it have a particular ethnic orientation?
So when I was growing up there, this was really before it was Koreatown. So it's now considered Koreatown. And before that, there were, I would say, it was predominantly African-American, Hispanic, and Caucasian.
And how did all those groups get along back then?
Actually, really well. I was there during the 1991 riots. I was at USC. I just graduated from USC, and my family lived, and they still lived there on the street right in that area. There was a lot of racial tension, but really in our own neighborhood, we didn't really experience any of that.
So living in that area, growing up in that area, was there some seed that was planted that got you thinking about law enforcement? I know you went to other careers before, but was there something about that area that made you think about it?
Well, my dad had friends that were police officers, and then I'd indicated before we went on the air that my family owned a restaurant called the New Moon Restaurant. It was at 9th and San Pedro. It's something my grandfather had started back, I believe, in the 30s. It'd been around for a long time, My grandfather was a Newton Booster, so Newton Division is where that restaurant was located, 9th and San Pedro. And I always remembered that he had a little sticker on the back of his Cadillac. He always, you know, this was part of the American dream. He had a new Cadillac every couple of years, and he always had to get a new sticker on the back window. It was a Newton Booster sticker. We always had police officers and councilmen in the restaurant. But even still, as a Chinese American, going into law enforcement, it was not really a career path that anyone had really considered for any of us. In fact, I'm the first in my family to be a police officer.
Captain Tom, I've heard you say once in a while, or at least more than once, that you are the third generation in your family that has lived the American dream, right?
Yes.
So your grandfather came over when?
So originally, it's kind of an interesting story because three generations of my family were born in China and came here separately. So essentially,
Mainland China.
They're from the Guangdong province, Toisan area. And so essentially, that's where most of the Chinese in the mid to late 1800s came from, that area, specifically Toisan. It was a very impoverished area, and they were recruited specifically for that reason, because they didn't have a lot of options. If you know your history, essentially what they were recruited for was as laborers. When they advertised over in China, they would say that America, the streets are paved in gold. You know, it's basically come here and you can just become rich. And so my great-great-grandfather came here in 1875. He was processed through Angel Island. And after some time, and I don't know the exact details, but after some time, he sent back for his son, who was my great-grandfather. And then after some time, my great-grandfather sent back for his son, who was born in China, and that was my grandfather. So my grandfather came over here. The first generation that was born in my family in America was my father's generation.
Did your grandfather experience racial discrimination?
Well, like one of the stories that I remember, so the neighborhood that I had mentioned that I grew up in, Country Club Park, was predominantly a Caucasian neighborhood. And when my father moved into that neighborhood, he was a young child. My father was born in 1938. And they moved there, I believe, in 1943. So it was during the World War II. And what my dad remembered as a young child was that basically neighbors would throw trash on their lawn every week. It was a regular occurrence that trash was being thrown on their lawn. It was very obvious that they weren't wanted there. But this was part of a time in our history when, you know, my family had done very well. You know, they had been worked hard. They'd owned farms and businesses, and so they were living their version of the American dream, and they were able to purchase in an area that was, you know, well-to-do at that time.
So you were, I'm going to guess you were born around 1968?
69, yes.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So where did your family live at that point?
Country Club Park.
That was still, okay.
So, well, let's see. And then, in 1969, we may have lived in Mount Washington, you know, but we ended up moving. My father was a chief consul for Congressman Augustus Hawkins. I don't know if you remember him, but he was a landmark congressman. You know, he really was paving a lot of roads and was involved in a lot of civil rights things. And my father was an attorney and a CPA, and he had ended up as his chief consul. And so we were bicoastal for a few years when he worked for him. So that's why I'm a little bit confused, you know, because it was so young. Yeah. So we ended up having a house, I know, in Mount Washington, and then we owned a place in Silver Springs, Maryland. So when Congress was in session, we would live on the East Coast in that home. My dad would go to work in Washington, D.C., and then, you know, we would go to school, you know, over there and then come back for the summer back to L.A.
You were truly bicoastal, and your father definitely had achieved the American dream. Not only had he reached some success, he actually had the ability to impact this democracy and the decisions that were made. That's pretty impressive. You eventually ended up at University High School. Tell us about the banners you checked on last week.
Yeah, so I'm always proud to say that in 1985 to 87, University High School, I was on the men's volleyball team, or boys volleyball team, as it were, and we won two city championships.
Were you a setter?
I was a setter and a back row specialist, primarily a back row specialist.
I only say that because you're not super tall.
This is true. This is
well,
and I know if I've played volleyball, right. So I would think that you would not be a hitter or a blocker.
No. So I mean, there were games, you know, and this was part of the fun of it, you know, when we would be way up on a team. you know, they would put me in and I'd get to hit you know, be on the front row and hit. But, you know, we really had a great experience in high school. Our coach was Neil Newman, which if anyone out there is listening to this and they have a way of getting in contact with him, I would love to contact him, because I really, and I tell coaches today, that you don't really realize the impact that you have on young men and women on their lives until they grow up, right? And then they look back and they go, wow, I really learned a lot in terms of discipline and hard work, teamwork, all those things. I really learned a lot from Coach Newman. I give him a lot of credit. And one of the things that we used to talk about was, so Pacific Palisades, everyone knows, is, you know, they're a powerhouse in volleyball. They have kids that grew up playing on the beach, and they're in club volleyball. And university high school wasn't really like that. You know, we had players that were very good, but the reason I believe that we won those two city championships beating Palisades was really because of the hard work and determination and scrappiness that this coach, Neil Newman, had really instilled in us.
It's inspiring.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at just the individual talent that Pacific Palisades had, and you compared it to our individual talent, you would say there's no way that these kids could beat them. But that's why I give so much credit to that coach. He was such a mentor to us. And, you know, when you're a young boy, you don't realize that you're being mentored.
Yeah.
But, you know, I look back fondly on that time period.
I think young people in general, and you and I may have talked about this before, you don't really realize you're being mentored, especially immigrants who are sort of going through various layers of sort of doubt and coping, until you grow up and you realize that there were elemental people along the way who really sort of encouraged you at important moments and sort of led you in the direction that you're going to go. So is University High School within your command right now?
It is, yeah. Mm. So the first, you had mentioned about the banner. So when I got here, one of the first things I did in the first week is I had to go visit the campus. Of course, it's much of it is the same, exactly the same, the main building. But there's a brand new gymnasium. So the old gymnasium where I played is no longer there. But in the new gymnasium, I wanted to make sure that the banners are still up there.
And are
so,
they?
So they are. They're still there.
Yeah. You know, I'm glad, because I'm a sports fan and played on my high school basketball team and love sports. I want to go back to one thing that you mentioned earlier, but you said that trash was thrown on the grounds of where your parents lived. Going back, now that you're a police officer, and we're all aware of issues of racial profiling and allegations that minorities are treated differently by law enforcement, do you think that that experience, having been a minority in a white area and having experienced racial discrimination, does that impact your policing nowadays, the way you handle things, the way you look at things? I'm just curious.
Sure. It's a fair question. I wouldn't say that I necessarily experienced the direct racism, because I think by the time I was growing up in the 70s and 80s in that area, it was very well integrated. It was a very nice area, but there were well-to-do families that lived in that neighborhood, both Hispanic and African American and Caucasian. I didn't particularly experience it myself, but of course, listening to the stories, I do remember, you know, so I think really the root of your question is about how have my experiences shaped my own experience as a police officer.
You right? said it better than I did, yes.
So I can recall a specific incident that I had. My mother's car got stolen. It was an Acura Integra. It got stolen back in the late 80s, and it got recovered. Unbeknownst to us, we were told to go pick it up, and we picked it up, but it was never entered into the system as a recovered vehicle. Mm-hmm. So it was still in the system as a stolen vehicle. And I recall I was in USC at the time, and I went to Disneyland with three other friends who happened to be Asian American. So there's four Asian American youths.
You were driving that car?
I'm driving that car.
And it comes back as stolen.
And it comes back as stolen, and we're in Anaheim, which has Asian gang issues, and we're in a stolen car, right? So we get pulled over. And it's a big to-do. They've got their guns out. There's helicopters. It's a whole thing. And so, but I automatically figure out exactly what's happening. Mm-hmm. And so I tell my friends in the car, relax. I know exactly what's happening. The car was stolen. Most likely they still think it's stolen. Just listen to them. Just do whatever they tell you to do. We're going to be fine. And so we go through that whole process where they pull us out of the car at gunpoint and they handcuff us and put us in the back of the car. And then I'm thinking to myself, now is an appropriate time for me to speak. Mm-hmm. So the entire time I didn't say anything at all because I knew what was going through their mind. You know, I'm a college student, you know.
They're worried that someone's got a gun or someone's going to.
Exactly. They don't
warrants
know.
Out or something.
As far as they know, this car is stolen and we stole the car. And so, but now that I'm handcuffed in the back seat of this car, and this is Anaheim Police Department back in the late 80s again, the window's cracked a little bit in the back, right? Mm-hmm. So the window's down a little bit and there's an officer standing there. And I said, excuse me, sir, if you check my driver's license, you'll see it's the same last name as the registered owner, which is my mother. And he looks at me and he took his flashlight and he hit the window.
Wow.
And he told me, shut the F up.
Yeah.
But he said the entire word.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so what did I do? I shut up because I thought to myself, this is not probably a good thing. So so he walks away. And then a few minutes later, there was a cadet that had walked near my window. So I thought, okay, here's another opportunity. So I said, sir, if you could just tell the officers that this is my family's car, this is all a mistake. And what did he say to me? Shut the F up.
Wow.
So this cadet had learned from this other officer mm-hmm. how to treat people. Mm-hmm. So obviously, you know, I knew that I was not in the wrong, but I also understood where the officers were coming from. That, of course, shaped in my mind how we should be dealing with people. I mean, you know, we have to treat people with respect. We have to be professional, even when they are criminals. Mm. And so the response of the officer was totally inappropriate. Mm. That's not something that, you know, even in today's LAPD, and, you know, we have grown by leaps and bounds in my own experience in terms of how we treat the public and the thoughtfulness that we approach the job with is very different than it was, I think, when I first started. That's not to say that we were rogue even, you know, 24 years ago, but I just think that we've evolved as an agency, as we should, and I think that we're doing a much better job today than we did
before. I'm really glad to hear that story because from my perspective, on the other side, I hear lots of clients saying, you know, the cops roughed me up. They treated me like dirt. They, you know, same kind of behavior you got. And it's refreshing for me to hear someone in charge say, you know, not every day, doesn't guide every action you do, but to know somewhere deep in your brain, you had that experience and probably would be willing to look at the possibility that a police officer might have acted inappropriately on a given situation because you've had that experience.
Yes, and I would say, I say this all the time. I'm not the apologist for all police. You know, I'm just not. We're not perfect. We come from the human race, you know, so that means that we have most people, honestly, and this is my own experience, and I've been very honest with you so far, and I'll continue to do so, the vast majority of our police officers are doing an outstanding job for the right reasons under extremely difficult circumstances.
I completely agree.
But we can't say that every single one of us is perfect. We can't say that every single one of us is doing the right thing all the time. And so that is part of my job, and it's always, ever since I've been a supervisor or even as an officer, it's all of our responsibilities to protect our image as a department. You know, the public needs to know that they can trust us. And so I would say, and I'll just wrap it up just because I know that you have some questions, but I had told you earlier when we were off air that my uncle was a public defender. So he spent his entire career in the LA County Public Defender's Office. I think it was almost 40 years. And the reason that he became a public defender was when we owned that restaurant downtown, mm-hmm. he had an experience himself where he had locked himself out of the restaurant and he was on the backside of the restaurant and he was trying to get into the door, the rear door of the restaurant, and a police officer saw him doing what he thought was a burglary. And he got rousted by the cops and he told them, you know, I own this restaurant. And, you know, he said he wasn't dressed very nicely and he kind of had a junky car at the time. And mm-hmm. so the officer didn't believe him. And what shaped his perspective was he thought, if this could happen to me, it could happen to anybody. So, yes, I fully agree, you know, that anything could happen. I don't believe that it happens on a wholesale basis, but I think in individual circumstances, can there be mistakes that we make? Can there be misperceptions about things? 100%. And I'm open to definitely to that idea. And so that's why we take our responsibility very seriously. in terms of rooting out if there's misconduct. You know, and Chief Moore has said this for all of the command staff, that if there's misconduct, that it is our job to root that out and take appropriate action. And we are committed to doing that.
I love that we're having a conversation in the States about people who have had experiences as a result of being minorities, who have then been able to go on in their professional lives and impact the trajectory of that misconduct as it applies to future generations. Your uncle definitely is one of them. Your father seemed to have been, and now you. I mean, I imagine that for you to be able to tell that story to the other officers in your command, it's so personal and it rings so real that it probably sort of makes them aware of their conduct every time they're pulling someone over. But I want to take you over to one of the command roles that you had. You'll have to tell me what it was called, but it's with a command that oversees the interaction of the police department with the public, right?
Right.
What's it called?
So the previous command, so I've been a captain now. This is my fifth year. I've been a captain at four other well, this is my fourth command as a captain. But the previous one to this was Critical Incident Review Division.
Right. And so there you got to review the way that the LAPD interacts with the public. I want you to tell us about it, but also, you know, the statistics, you know, where is LA or LAPD as far as just violent interaction of the police department with people? Where do we rank, high or low?
Well, specifically, I was there for approximately a year and a half, and so I was involved in the 2018 year-end review. It's a use force report that LAPD puts together. It's a, you know, I was really proud of the work that we had done. It's about a 430-page document that's available online. It's, you know, it's available to anyone for them to review. But one of the things that we did in preparation for that is looking at all the statistics, and so in 2017, as an example. Well, let me back up. LAPD contacts approximately 1 million people a year. And so when I say that contacts, that doesn't mean like this right here. I'm not counting this as two contacts. It's contacts would be a radio call. It would be an arrest, some kind of observation-related activity. So that's a million people. And so in 2018, there were approximately 2,100 what we call a non-categorical use of force, which would be like a lower level use of force. And then we had 33 officer-involved shootings in 2018. In 2017, we had 44. So we had about a 25% reduction in officer-involved shootings. And in 2019, we had another reduction down to 26 officer-involved shootings.
And you think that's not coincidence. You think that's based upon better training, more awareness on behalf of the officers?
I do think that, you know, and I could explain, you know, of course, when it was statistics, you know, there's the saying, Mark Twain was famous for saying that there's lies, damn lies, and then there's statistics because statistics can be, you know, skewed in different ways.
Of course.
However, you know, I do think that the numbers are encouraging, you know, so what we did in 2017, 2018, the LAPD really started pushing a concept of de-escalation. Basically, we pushed out through the department this concept of basically de-escalating through the use of planning, assessment, utilization of time. So using distance and cover to create more time, which gives you more time to make decisions, more resources. And so we had an acronym called PATROL. And so that was planning, assessment, time, redeployment, right? So that's another concept that we really weren't familiar with as LAPD officers, that we never really, when I came on, we weren't taught to redeploy. We were taught stand your ground. And so redeployment is another one. And then lines of communication, and that's lines of communication not only with your partners, but with the suspects and with other resources that are coming in. So really, what I'm describing is a more thoughtful approach in how we're dealing with critical incidents that has really enabled us to, I think, minimize the dynamic nature of some of these circumstances. Sometimes you can't avoid it. Sometimes things happen so quickly. And that's something that in my role at Critical Incident Review Division, I read transcripts and watched videos of, you know, dozens and dozens of officer-involved shootings, is how quickly these things happen.
Devolve, yeah.
I mean, just incredible what our officers are doing, and really heroic things are happening on a regular basis that the public generally doesn't know about. But so, just one other thing is that the LAPD now has a what they call a 45-day release video. So if you haven't seen it, LAPD headquarters has a channel on YouTube that anyone can go to, and they can watch these videos basically narrated by LAPD about these critical incidents.
Wow. Yeah. Didn't know. So interesting that you mentioned this, because next month we'll be speaking to Steve Soboroff, who was the police commission president and then the vice president for a while. And he was telling me that the idea of police officers, LAPD, wearing cameras was something that came out of the police commission. It didn't have a lot of support. And so they went out to the community and they sort of drummed up support for that idea, and that it's become it's become a resource, and that it sort of demonstrates the fact that LAPD really does go out of its way to practice de-escalation. And so that's probably one of the reasons why the interaction with the public is sort of less violent than we might be used to in other major cities with the same numbers.
I think that when you watch these videos, if you haven't seen any of them, I do encourage you to go onto that YouTube channel and take a look at some of them. You will be shocked at how, number one, I said how quickly they happen, but mm-hmm. how much we're doing to try to avoid these instances. So if an encounter is going on for any number of minutes, you will see officers continually using all these things that I talked about in the patrol acronym. You'll see them trying to talk this person down. You'll see them trying to redeploy. You'll see them moving around and communicating with each other and really trying to minimize the chance that we're going to use the deadly force. Of course, if you see the video, then that means that some kind of deadly force occurred.
Mm.
But what you will see is that we are really trying to not use it. It's really, I think, like you said, you know, when you watch those body-worn videos, we had never seen those things before.
Right.
And even internally as police officers, you hear about, you know, what occurred, but it's very different to see it, you know. And that's the comment that I've gotten from a lot of community members when they watch these videos or when they watch actual live incidents unfolding in front of them is, gosh, I could never be a police officer because I would have shot that guy right away.
Has there been any negative response from rank and file officers to having to wear body cams?
I think that, being honest, nobody likes having a camera on them. I mean, if you think about your own daily lives, would any one of us like to just have a camera on us?
I would not, for sure.
100% of the time, you know, and so I mean that's the reality. But this is part of the evolving nature of police work. I
right.
mean, this is part of what the public wants. But what I tell officers is, you can't look at it as a negative thing. This is actually positive, because the reality is, as I indicated before, the vast majority of officers are doing the right thing for the right reasons under extremely difficult circumstances. And when you watch these videos, it actually shows more often than not that we are doing the right thing.
Well, not only does it protect the officers when they're doing the right thing, because you've got proof, but from my perspective as a defense lawyer, it's really helpful, because if somebody is guilty, I mean, like a DUI, and there they are stumbling around, and they told me they were fine, there were no issues, and I've got this camera video, I can say to them, you know, we better see about working this out, because
right.
you know, it doesn't look the way you described it. And they say, oh, I don't remember that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so, you know, what cameras do is they provide truth. I mean, it's not 100% of the picture.
Right.
You may not get the whole story. You may not get every word that's spoken, but it's good for the officer's protection, and it's good for the public. In case there is an officer that acts inappropriately, that person will have some protection.
I do agree. It works both ways. And we do see that officers in general are doing the right thing. And so we have many complaints that now we're able to resolve them as demonstrably false, because someone will say an officer said so-and-so, or they did, you know, whatever they're being accused of. And we can watch the video and we can see either the officer did or they didn't do, or they either said or they didn't say whatever they're being accused of. Because of the way the policy is written, the officers are required to turn on their cameras before they make contact with someone. And so you're able to see the entire interaction with people. And then there's a buffer. There's a two-minute video buffer that occurs. So once you activate the camera, it goes back 2 minutes, and it's capturing what happened 2 minutes prior to the actual activation of it.
Amazing. 21st century policing. And I think it's interesting what you guys say, because most people think of police body cameras as the method by which, you know, bad conduct is shown. And it's interesting to think that it's maybe far more often the method by which good conduct is shown. I want to ask you about this 21st century policing here in Los Angeles. Homelessness is a big issue. Over in the Palisades, we have an entire extra LAPD detail that we were able to secure because of our unique position vis-a-vis homelessness. We had a shoreline that hosted quite a few homeless people on the beach for a while, and then we have our mountainsides, which were natural places for people to create encampments. And so we were able to go to then Chief Beck, and we were able to secure, over the course of time, first we got one person, and then we were able to secure an entire LAPD detail that now spends a lot of time interacting with our homeless people. So I want to ask you, what does that look like for LAPD? I'm sure that today versus 30 years ago, police officers are spending much more time than they did before interacting with homeless people. And although, you know, not all homeless people are created equal, not all mindsets are the same, you don't catch them always at a great time, I'm sure that those can be challenging. How is that for the department, and are those also recorded?
So what I see as an area captain is that the homelessness issue is really like one of the biggest complaints that I get. You know, when I'm speaking to community members at various community groups and council organizations, homelessness comes up all the time. And of course, none of us can drive around the city or even wherever you live. So I live outside of the city, and I'm seeing it in my city. I live in the city of Long Beach. You see it everywhere, right? So it's unavoidable. And yet what LAPD has done over the years is we've been asked to basically deal with this homelessness issue. And really, it's not a police issue. Mm. What has happened in the last few months or even the last year with LAPD is you've seen some of the roles change in terms of who is the focus in terms of enforcement and dealing with homelessness. And so right now, under the Unified Homelessness Response Center, UHRC, the sanitation department is the lead entity in terms of going out and cleaning up homeless encampments.
Didn't know that.
A few years ago, I was at Olympic Division as a detective commanding officer, and we had established one of the first HOPE details, a divisional HOPE detail, and that was with Officer Joe Cerrito. And he was really like doing a lot of, in my mind, pioneering work. And I think a lot of this kind of approach was being done in Central Division because they have such an obviously world-renowned Skid Row area. But we were seeing an increase, this is about 4 or 5 years ago, in Olympic Division, and what Joe was doing was going out and trying to offer resources. As a HOPE officer, he was directing sanitation to come in and do cleanups and the street cleaning and all these things. And then over time that has evolved where now that's really is being pushed by the city council offices. They have direct access to scheduling for the CARE and CARE Plus cleanups. Mm-hmm. If you don't know, those are comprehensive cleanups that are done by the sanitation department. When they go out, ostensibly, they have social workers that go out, and then LAPD will also go out. And it's a multi-prong approach. It's kind of like what we're referring to as a whole-of-government approach, that LAPD can't do this by themselves.
Right.
And the reality is, you know, we have the Chief Moore has established a homelessness coordinator. Hmm. That's Commander Don Graham. And, you know, in speaking to him, and I've been coming to West LA, I'm learning a lot, even more about homelessness. And what I've learned is that for LAPD, number one, all homeless people or persons experiencing homelessness are not criminals, right? So even the majority of them are not. But there, of course, are criminal elements within that population, just like there are within any population. Most of the people are suffering from either some kind of financial hardship or they've had some terrible crime done to them. They've got a mental illness. They've got some kind of drug abuse, issues going on. And so a lot of them are accepting help when we do offer it to them. Yeah. And then there's others that are what we call service resistant. But in terms of like LAPD, what we look at is we want to lead with services. So again, with that approach, with the thought process and philosophy that homelessness is not a crime, we're going to try to help people when we can. And if there are violations of the law, then we will take appropriate, you know, action related to that. But we don't want to just criminalize someone just because they happen to be without
a home.
They're
experiencing homelessness.
Right.
Right. You went to law school, right? Tell us a little bit about your education, but ultimately you did go to law school. I wonder how that colors or impacts the perspective you have now as a police officer.
Well, so the long story short is that I went to Whittier Law School for a year. And then, you know, in between the first and second year, it's typical that you get a law clerk job. So I got a law clerk job at the city attorney's office, LA City Attorney's Office.
Downtown?
Downtown. I worked
criminal?
Gail Takahashi. She actually wasn't criminal. It was in, I think she had to do with a real estate section. And, you know, long story short, and I have the 10 minutes in my head, but the when I was in the first year of law school, especially at Whittier, they really like stressed, you know, look around, only half of you are going to graduate. And of the half that graduate, only half of those people will actually practice law. And so they were basically saying in your first year, only 25% of you, one in four, is actually going to graduate and practice law. So make sure this is what you want to do. And so that was in my head. And so as a law clerk, I really just didn't enjoy the legal research that I was doing over the summer, and ended up talking to my boss and a city attorney. And she said, go talk to my husband. He loves his job. And it turned out he was Terry Hara, who ends up retiring as a deputy chief from LAPD. He was the first Asian-American deputy chief in the history of the department. But at the time, he was a sergeant. And he told me all about the job and how you can make a difference, and you know, and how you know, every day is a little bit different. And he really sold me on it. And yeah. I always say, much to the chagrin of my parents, I went home and I told them that I'm going to quit law school and I'm going to pursue a career in LAPD. And that's what I did. I can't look back because I think that this has been a great career. I feel like I've been able to make, you know, small impacts. You know, no one changes the world, you know, wholesale by themselves. That you can only just make incremental little impacts, I think, every day, you know, just by even by being nice to people.
Yeah.
I think is helping to change the world one little act at a time.
Especially as a police officer, yeah. Because, you know, most people, when you're driving down the street and you see a police officer behind you, you start looking at your speedometer. Am I going too fast? Did I cut off that person? Did I do something? And the uniform can be intimidating, and it makes so much difference to have a smiling face, right, treat you like a person and not like you're here and I'm, you know, better or I have more power than you.
Right. No, and we're all human beings and we're all trying to get along. We all have different jobs and we can impact the world in different ways. So what you're saying kind of reminds me of a real quick story. I was in Century City Mall, back the old iteration of it, when I was a young police officer, and I got approached by someone who said, "Officer Tom." Mm. And I turned around and I was like, "Oh, you look like a nice guy. Do we know each other from somewhere?" And he goes, "You don't remember me. You arrested me." And I was like, "Oh my gosh, what's this going to turn out to be?" But he was smiling and he said, "I just want to thank you for the way that you treated me. Even though, you know, you arrested me, I understood why I got arrested, but you were professional and you were compassionate, you know, and I just want to tell you thank you." And that actually That's really amazing. Impacted me as a young officer also.
I want to ask you something before, because I know Steve is going to take you over to the Palisades. I just want to ask you a quick question.
Physically, just okay. Spiritually.
I'm ready to go.
Spiritually.
A global question. So you said that as captain, you get assigned to various commands and you don't have much say about it. So you'll get a call that says, "Hey, we're promoting you or we're placing you somewhere. You know, congratulations, you're the commanding officer," and you pretty much say thank you. I have a question about police officers. Mm-hmm. So not in the commanding level, but at the officer level. Do they have a say in where they go? And the reason I ask is what Steve was bringing up. You know, to some degree, I assume that police department officers have a degree of comfort in some neighborhoods versus others. And how you interact with the people you come across through the course of your day, and I mean, that's your job, right? You're doing it presumably for the lion's share of your life. How you interact with those people is impacted by whether or not you enjoy being there, if you like the vibe, whatever. Do officers have a say in where they are? I mean, if they're particularly uncomfortable somewhere, can they be redeployed? Or if they feel like they're really not fit for a certain community, can they ask to be moved?
Absolutely. Yeah, so officers have a lot of freedom in terms of applying. They can apply for upgrades, promotions, or even if as a lateral, they can put in for positions. So if you're working West LA and you'd like to work in South LA, or you want to work in the Valley, you can apply for any one of those jobs. Not apply, actually, just put in a transfer request. Mm. And when the opening occurs, then they can
They'll
move
put you in there.
Right. So, yeah. So officers, especially unless you're on probation, when you're on probation, you get sent where you get sent based on the needs of the department and the city. But otherwise, when you're a tenured employee at basically all ranks below captain. You can put in for many different assignments. They have a lot of opportunities to move around.
So presumably people who are working in a certain neighborhood are comfortable there.
If they've been in an assignment for any number of years, it's because they choose to stay there. But I would say that for me, because I went to high school here and I did probation here, like this is just a happy coincidence. I'm really happy to be in West LA. This is a great community. My officers are great. And I just, I've loved it so far.
Good. Since this is the Palisades podcast, I know you've only been in command here for a short time. What do you see about our community, the Palisades? What do you see as positives, negatives? Do you have any thoughts on what you'd like to try to do to change policing in the Palisades?
Well, truthfully, what I see is the Pacific Palisades Task Force on Homelessness is just an incredible, you know, organization. I mean, I went to the homeless count. I went out on a ride along with Sharon Kilbride and Rusty, and we actually had brought along Michelle Bisnoff from the Brentwood Community Council. Because I really, in my mind, again, I've only been here a few weeks, but when I look at what they've done, it's really incredible. And I know Miriam was very instrumental in the formation.
The first chair, yeah. Right. And it was, it was a tough sell to the community, but once we got going, people were glad to have us there. And that's part of the reason why it functions. People are happy to, you know, see it function.
But I'll tell you, so when I went on that ride along, what I was really impressed with, and I'd never seen this before, but there was a homeless gentleman that was coming to meet the social workers that were going to meet them. We were out on Will Rogers Beach. And what was explained to me was that he needs medicine. So he needed some kind of psych meds. And the nurse practitioner that is working with the people's concern was coming out and doing what's called street medicine. I'd never even heard of that before. But I thought, wow, what an incredible opportunity for not only that person, but for us as social workers and for us as police officers to be involved in giving this person something that they need. And that's so helpful, not only just for that individual, but now we have one less person that potentially has some kind of psych issues that now is on medication that can help that person control their, you know, whatever their urges are. I mean, that's really, I think, part of the success of that whole program. And really just watching the way that Sharon and the social workers interacted with the people and Rusty too. Rusty was there. They all like are just so filled with compassion and purpose. And I was really impressed with that. And that's why I wanted Michelle to come out there so that she could really see that. It's one thing hearing about it, but it's another to actually see what's going on. So just to follow up, and you had asked, like, what are the concerns? So Rusty had taken me up into the Bluffs area. And I saw some of the remnants of homeless encampments there. And so I am very concerned, like the citizens are in Palisades, about brush fires and other concerns. And I know we've got an evacuation drill that we're going to be working with the fire department on. Coming up in May. So my biggest concerns are the homelessness. I'm talking about specifically Palisades homelessness. And then also these fires. And how are those two connected?
Let me raise one other issue that is kind of a big issue in the Palisades is the fact that we're kind of remote compared to the rest of your area. And as I understand it, we have one designated police car for the Palisades. But if that car is busy with an arrest or called somewhere else, do you see any way of making people know that there is a police presence in the Palisades, even though we're farther away from the rest of the area, the district?
Well, there's, you know, obviously there's no guarantee that there's going to be a car in any given moment in that area. However, just to put it in perspective, so LAPD West LA Division covers 65 square miles, approximately 64.7 square miles. And I always say, like, when I think about that, the city of San Francisco is 49 square miles. So West LA is larger than the entire city of San Francisco. We have one of the smallest commands in terms of personnel, and yet we answered 66,000 radio calls in 2019. That being said, we are all aware, and even when I was on probation, it was made known that Adam 1 covers basically Pacific Palisades area, that car should be staying in that area, right? And that's essentially what we do. We have a sister car for that car, which covers the Brentwood area, which is 8 Adam 13. Ideally, those two cars should stay there, but especially Adam 1 should stay in that area. Okay. So when calls are dropping in other areas, we expect the other cars in the other areas to pick them up, but sometimes it's unavoidable. What we especially want to avoid is 8 Adam 1 getting tasked to handle a call down in 8 Adam 95, which is the total opposite end of the division down on, because it's so far. The travel time to travel from 8 Adam 1 down to the opposite end of the division just is a long time outside of that area. So we really strive to keep that car in the area. We want them just patrolling around in that area. And, of course, as Mary had indicated, Palisades specifically is fortunate. You have that beach area, and that's enabled us to assign a beach detail. So Rusty and Jimmy are assigned to that beach detail, and that's the detail that she's referring to. Yeah. And then you have your senior lead officer, Mike Moore.
I want to ask you about another aspect of the Palisades, and that is the parks. You already know this. One of our biggest worries in Pacific Palisades are fires for a variety of reasons, whether they're natural or man-made. The fact is that evacuating out of the Palisades is a difficult thing to do. But we have a couple of parks, and Potrero Canyon is going to be opening. And I sit on one of the park boards, and one of the worries is that kids light up things. And in the process of that lighting up, we're always sort of worried about the fire threat. Enforcement is sparse. We all know this. I mean, there just aren't enough LAPD cars to put on every street in Los Angeles. So we know that, you know, calling the police and expecting them to be able to show up inside of 2 minutes or 5 minutes is really unrealistic. So I want to ask you, what can people do? What can the parks do? As a rule, when Palisadians see something that alarms them and they think they need a police presence, what is there that can be done? I mean, what's another citing agency other than the police? And, you know, what generally can be done when you know you live in a town where you only have one car and, you know, response time is going to be slow. And if anything terrible happens, evacuating is going to be hard.
So obviously, if it's inside a city park, we have the LA City Park Rangers. They have enforcement capability. And then, you know, really us. And so what I would say is that we do want to be aware of those issues. So if you see the kids hanging out in the park or they're hanging out wherever it is, what I would ask is that you call the non-emergency line, the 877-ASK-LAPD, and let it get sent out as a radio call. Let our officers know that there's an issue, and then we will attempt to respond to it. The reality is that, like I said, 66,000 radio calls, we have to triage these radio calls. Mm-hmm. But there are times in the day where there's not much going on. I mean, that's just the reality. So you don't know as a caller, as a citizen in the community, you don't know whether that time officer is available or not. It could happen that the officer is not doing anything right at that moment. The call comes in and they can go shoot over to that park and they can shoo those kids away or cite them or do whatever is appropriate right at that time. But
Saying make the call.
I would say make the call. Call 877-ASK-LAPD. And also I would, you know, you all should have Mike Moore's email address. And if not, then I'm sure that you guys can put that out there.
So, yeah we do have Mike Moore's email.
So one of the biggest problems that I run into in general, like when I go to community meetings, is people say, well, this happens all the time. And then so I will have my staff run what's called a calls for service history, and then we find out there's no calls or there's very few calls. So the reality is that if it's not put on record, then we have very little that we can do about it. So
right. The
example would be like party houses. So if you, as a community member, you have got a house that's down the street from you, as an example, let's say it's an Airbnb house and it's constantly being rented out for parties. And if you're not calling the police, then we have no awareness of that. And if you can complain about it, you know, at your community meetings, you can complain to Mike Moore about it. But until we start building a history on that specific address, there's very little that we can do. So on that topic, one thing that we're doing is we're really trying to push now more enforcement and documentation specific to party houses and even some houses in Brentwood.
I want to say our senior lead officer, who everybody hopefully knows is Michael Moore, not the chief, but the senior lead, he does always say the same thing. He says, you know, make that call, because once it goes into the database, then, you know, if something pings often enough, then it gets more attention. So
yes.
I thank you for that advice. We will put that out there. Everyone who listens to this podcast, tell your friends, make the call. reach out to Officer Moore, reach out to Captain Tom. He's very accessible. He tells me he believes in community policing by being in the community. So it is absolutely a pleasure to have you on this podcast.
You.
It's been a pleasure to get to know you, and thank you for your service. And we're very glad you're here at this command.
Could I add one more thing?
Of course.
If you don't mind. So we've had a few stolen vehicles where people are leaving their key fob in the car. When we have daily crime meetings, I'm talking to the detectives, and then they'll say, oh, a car was stolen in Pacific Palisades. We had one recently. And I look at the make and model of the car, and I'm like, this is a 2019 Tesla. How are they stealing this car without, you know, it's got all these whiz-bang security features. Well, the key fob is left in the car, right? Well, that kind of makes it easy. So I'm just asking people to, you know, as safe and comfortable as you are in your neighborhoods, please don't leave
the keys in the car.
Don't make it easy for
even in your own garage,
especially in your driveway or in front of your house. Don't leave things visible. So that's the old lock it, hide it, keep it. Keep things out of view. Don't make it an attractive, thing for criminals to come in. Most of them are looking for easy targets.
Right.
They're looking for the quick window that they can smash and grab a camera bag or a laptop. Or if there happens to be, you know, a key fob in the car, they're going to door check. That's what we call, like, if the key fob's in the car, the door is going to open up.
And then when they get in, the car is going to start.
And we're pretty sure that's what happened on this one, is that someone was door checking, got in the car, happened to put, because the fob was left in the car by a valet. So they had, couple had gone out the night before, they valeted it, and the valet had left the key fob in the car. The guy drove home and he didn't think about it. He left his car and went inside. But so I'm pretty sure that someone door checked, got inside, and then pushed the start button and said, oh, great, I have a car.
I'm leaving.
Well, hopefully everybody that listens to this will pay attention. Yeah. I want to join Mariam. It's been a pleasure having you here. Thank you so much, and welcome to the Palisades, and we hope to have you here for a long, long time.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Captain Tom.